What is it that makes the British seaside sinister? Why does it seem to attract so many killers? Is it the fact that the tide washes away their sins? Is it the fact that it's the end of the line? There's nothing overly frightening about a big wheel or a carousel. But what is undeniable is that the British seaside attracts and has always attracted death and murder. Hello, I'm Geoffrey Wonsall. I write about crime, true crime. And in this new series, I want you to join me on a journey to the cliff's edge, where land meets the sea and where life meets death.
Whilst some may consider my opinions to be bold, they have been formed after writing bestsellers about real killers for the past 30 years and staring evil in the face.
For make no mistake, there is something sinister about our British seaside towns. On the surface, they're all funfairs, candy floss and breezy promenades. But by digging a little deeper in the sand, we uncover an underworld of misfits and misfeasance, murder and mayhem. And reveal the dark lives of the most deadly coastal killers to ever stalk our shores. Today, we're in Hastings to meet a killer who was only caught after one of the most complex murder investigations ever conducted along the South Coast. His name, Graham Fisher.
Horrifying though it is to say, by the end of the 1990s, the English seaside town was in terminal decline. Package holidays to Spain, and then to Turkey, and later to Thailand, had rendered it irrelevant. No one wanted to go there anymore. Nowhere epitomised it better than Hastings in East Sussex, where these two particularly unpleasant, horrifying crimes took place. But they didn't start in Hastings. They started in Bromley in London.
Graham Fisher is a man who is convicted of killing two women in Hastings and attempting to rape and attempting to murder another woman within the space of 7 days in 1998. He was born in 1973. And when convicted, was 36 years of age. He was convicted of a further two rapes and is considered as one of the most dangerous people we've dealt with in Sussex. The threat that he presents to women, especially vulnerable women, is huge.
When you sit down and look at the timeline from his childhood through to his actual incarceration in prison, when he was arrested and charged with murders and found guilty, or time in Broadmoor, when you start looking at the timeline, it's a classic serial killer profile that you can actually start put together. From a very dysfunctional background as a child, the parental home, so he was not aware of moral boundaries, he was not getting the right discipline as a child. As he grew older, his behaviour got worse to the point where people alienated and did ostracise him because people don't want to hang around with people who behave in such an abhorrent way. He started out as a schoolyard bully where he would start fighting, calling names initially, but then that would deteriorate into fighting, to actually causing serious harm to other children, boys and girls. And very often, sometimes, adults who tried to intervene to break up the fight. This gave him that excitement, that gave him the buzz, that gave him that feeling of power, because he was a big lad anyways, and that control over people, because he could then be seen and respected for his, basically his fighting ability, his pugilistic skills. And people respected him for that, which is something that he'd not really had throughout his childhood.
When looking at Graham Fisher's background, we obviously looked at his teenage years, and although we weren't able to get specific information, we did talk to people who knew him when he was a teenager, who had been to school with him, and he was very much described as a strange and violent individual at that time. So to a certain extent, he was the archetypical school bully. His size was a factor in his life. He didn't like the size he was, but he also used it to good effect to threaten people. So probably more minor crimes were committed when he was at school as a young person. When he started to form relationships with people when growing up in and around the Bromley area, I believe that's when those crimes became more serious, and certainly there are instances of serious sexual assaults occurring at that time when he was in his late teens in the Bromley area.
Graham Fisher was an overweight, arrogant, bullying and sexually predatory 18-year-old. In 1991, in his native Bromley, southeast of London, he attacked a vulnerable lady. Not once, but twice. He attacked her in her home and left her. One day later, he returned and attacked her again. He attacked her so viciously that she almost died. There is something about this young man that you could not possibly forgive.
When dangerous people target vulnerable people, they do so quite deliberately. There is that element of knowing that they are easily targeted and that they can be selected quite without difficulty. And Graham Fisher was manipulative and direct in the way that he chose his victims.
The feeling of power and control is never quite satiated. What happens then is it develops into much more abhorrent behaviour, so it becomes not only a slap, it becomes a beating. And that level of power that's asserted has to continue to grow and develop, because all the while it's never ever quite sufficient to make them feel as though they were completed what they wanted to do, because the person might get up and walk away, other people might come to that other person's support, which causes further harm and to their own self-esteem, the bully's self-esteem. And this is what happened with Graham Fisher. As he grew older, he needed more and more excitement. He needed to feel respected. He needed to feel the power and control that his physical presence, he felt, deserved.
People do not go out and kill straight away. What they often do is build up. So they have sexual assaults or physical assaults on people. They do that, they build up the skills, they learn from their mistakes. I've dealt with killers who have also learnt by accident how to improve their techniques. So they do something and it works and they say, oh, I like that, and they incorporate that in the next attack. And they work up their skills till eventually they can then kill.
Fisher later admitted that he loved the scared look on his victim's face. Can you imagine the kind of belligerence that an 18-year-old can bring to bear on a vulnerable elderly lady that gives him pleasure from scaring her to death? It's inconceivable. But 2 years later, he's moved to the Isle of Wight, and the connection with the sea and seaside is formed. He has a partner whom he takes offence at. He ties her up and tries to strangle her. But just to add a little piquancy to the crime, he burns her son, not by him, her son's genitals. Again, it is inconceivable to imagine how unpleasant this young man was. He was a monstrous creature on the loose.
The growing catalogue of offences committed by Fisher were difficult for even the most experienced and hardened of police officers to comprehend.
It's difficult to go into too much detail about the early offences in Bromley because of the nature of the victim. But it is fair to say that they were sort of domestically related, not involving members of his own family, but people that were acquaintances. And one of those acquaintances is somebody who he attacked. And was eventually charged with serious sexual offences against.
This time, the authorities catch up with Fisher and he gets 2 years for assault. He should have got far more, in my opinion, but then perhaps those were different days. When he's released, he disappears, this time away from the Isle of Wight on a journey that takes him through Kent, another series of seaside towns, Gravesend, and ends up in Hastings in East Sussex, which becomes his killing ground.
Fisher, to all intents and purposes, looked a perfectly ordinary young man. But actually, he was a sexual sadist. There can be no doubt about it. And his behaviour, as he grew into a 20-year-old, was increasingly frightening.
Fisher's desire to inflict pain upon others reached a new zenith when he attacked two innocent young women in the seaside town of Eastbourne.
Graham Fisher was convicted of two sexual assaults in May 1998. He attacked two foreign students, two young foreign students who we would now regard as vulnerable. He attacked them in Eastbourne. He sexually assaulted both and he committed those offences with a knife. He was arrested a very short while later and was sentenced to a lengthy term of imprisonment. He went into the prison system and it became apparent to the prison authorities that he presented, in their words, such a grave and immediate danger to women that when he was approaching the end of that sentence, he was then moved to Broadmoor Hospital. And he's never left Broadmoor Hospital since that time. And it was whilst Graham Fisher was at Broadmoor Hospital in the summer of 2008 that he started to make admissions to his clinicians of his previous offending. He said to them, "It's very difficult to live with these things in your head."
Mm-hmm.
He harboured desires that were almost impossible to conceal. No one can say that a murderer is inevitable. No one can say that it was impossible to predict. But in Fisher's case, it would be difficult to deny that he was a time bomb waiting to go off. In the end, in Hastings, in East Sussex, he happens upon a woman, lonely, vulnerable, kindly, a bit of a recluse, lives near him. She's called Claire Letchford. Fisher decides that her life must end.
Claire Letchford lived in the basement flat of 46 Cornwallis Gardens, a large property which was divided into flats at the time, and Claire lived in that basement flat. She had difficulties in her life and found life quite a challenge and was most certainly very vulnerable. She was quite reclusive and kept herself to herself, but Graham Fisher, having lived in that same property, knew that Claire Letchford lived in the lower basement flat, and he deliberately targeted her.
He doesn't want to steal her money. He doesn't want to inherit her house. There is no connection between them, except he's lived nearby. But he wants to terminate her life. He does it in the most brutal and unacceptable way, until this poor, reclusive, lonely woman loses her life. What is the reason for it? The answer lies entirely in his personality, in the fact that something within him drives him to destroy vulnerable elderly women. And he does it in such a way that Wiz is so depraved that it's almost impossible to imagine. It's bad enough killing a poor, innocent 40-year-old woman living on her own. But not only does he do that, he then proceeds to eat part of her flesh. Now, is there any conceivable explanation for that? Answer, no, there cannot be. Is there any exculpation? No, there can't be any. What you're dealing with here in Fisher is a young man who is genuinely insane.
We believe he sexually assaulted her, tried to strangle her, and set fire to her body, dragging her body out into the hallway by one arm. He piled some clothing and other flammable material onto her body and set fire to it. And we know that Claire suffered a very awful and painful death because she was alive when that fire was set. When he started to tell the authorities in the hospital about some of his offending, he said that he had cut a piece of flesh away from her arm and eaten it.
There is some suggestion that he bit her arm. Now, whether he actually bit and ate a lot of raw flesh, I think is unlikely, because that you would really have to be quite mentally disturbed to do that. But certainly there is a history of cannibalism in this country. People do eat body parts. Sometimes it's out of mental illness, sometimes it's some cultural value. I mean, in the old days, the idea was that people ate the bodies of people they killed to gain their powers and increase their own strength. Now, I'm not suggesting that was driving him, but to bite raw skin and raw flesh is actually unusual these days.
Fisher did not just attack his victim. He brutalized her. In the end, he strangled her using his shoelaces and then smothered her with a cushion. Now, it's impossible to conceive how you could do that, to take the life of a vulnerable, lonely, utterly defenseless, innocent woman and not be plagued with guilt. But Fisher was not plagued with any sense of guilt whatever. Indeed, his carnal desires were only inflamed by the act of killing her. Fisher was not content, however. He had already killed one woman. He was not finished. Not for one second was he finished. Barely 8 days after Graham Fisher had killed the first time poor, reclusive 40-year-old Claire Letchford, who had had the misfortune for Fisher to experiment with cannibalism. He'd cut off part of her arm and eaten it. Fisher killed again. Another vulnerable, lonely person in Hastings. But this time, she was called Beryl O'Connor. She was unmarried and she was 75.
Beryl O'Connor, known locally as Dawny, lived in Clifton Court, just a short distance away, about 150 yards away from the flat where Claire Letchford had lived. Dawny lived alone, and she lived on the fifth floor of Clifton Court, close to where Graham Fisher had previously, for a very short period, rented a flat. And Graham Fisher knew that Dawny lived alone in that property.
25 years I've known Beryl, and she was the consultant for Helen Rubinstein in Debenhams, and she was very, very good at her job. She was a lady. She was very sweet. She was demure. She was clever, very clever. Dawny's motto was, if you couldn't say anything nice about someone, don't say anything at all.
She just had a very sweet nature, and she sort of had a lovely, sweet way of talking to people, and she was just a really, really lovely, lovely lady.
She was always with her husband, of course, because she had no family. Her mother had died while we were at the store, and of course when her mother died, she'd got no one at all other than the friends that were at work or her husband. And so therefore that was it was mostly visiting the public houses with him.
After her husband passed away, Dawny remained a very popular and much loved member of the community. But friends worried for her safety now that she was on her own.
We were waiting for something to happen, shall we put it that way? The girls and I, we used to discuss things like that. And, you know, it was often said among the crowd, she's got to be careful, you know. I think that perhaps the only place she knew if she wanted any recreation was that place along there by the White Rock. And they all knew her, of course, because she used to go in with him a lot. Now, whether anyone tagged on to her, that's the only explanation I could give. I'm sure that could be it.
We do know that after the murder of Claire Letchford on the 19th of January 1998, Dawnie became very concerned about her own safety. And in fact, she even told officers who were making inquiries in local properties around the murder of Claire Letchford that she felt quite vulnerable and unsafe as a result of what had happened to Claire. So it is quite obvious that Dawnie was feeling frightened and intimidated. And exactly a week after Claire was murdered, Dawnie was visited by Graham Fisher. We believe that Graham Fisher listened at the door of Dawnie's flat, listening to as to who was in that property before he forced his way in, tried to strangle her and set fire to her. He set fire to her by paper and some clothing being put onto her body, setting fire to it and leaving the premises. Fire brigade were called, and again it was immediately obvious that this was a murder scene, and a further second murder inquiry began in that last week of January in 1998.
Well, as I said, initially straight away from pulling up outside, literally before I even got off the fire plants, and I could see the other crime scene. The flat layout is two bedrooms, as I recall, as you went in the flat door, which was open when the first crews went in, so they didn't have force entry, the flat was open. When I went into the bedroom, Beryl was laid flat on her back with her head furthest from the door towards the window. It's quite a small bedroom with a bed. It was quite untidy. There's a lot of newspapers on the floor, magazines. And I remember Beryl was laid with her head away from the door, feet towards the door. Her clothing was quite dishevelled. Her skirt was a bit down, and one of her footwear was off. I think it was like a slipper. And she was burnt mainly on the right-hand side and around her upper torso and face, which was quite black and reddened from the fire. And her left hand, I believe, was raised above her head, and her right hand was down. So she was clearly deceased. The smoke was starting to clear, we could see that.
Beryl died as a result of strangulation, not of smoke inhalation. I can only assume it was in Graham Fisher's mind that if he could destroy the scene, it would cover up his crime of murder. It is quite common in cases of arson where a body is involved, that they think by setting fire to a place, they could well destroy evidence. But unfortunately for Graham Fisher, the fire wasn't of sufficient intensity to destroy any evidence. The flat, the actual bedroom itself, suffered some minor fire damage, smoke damage, and the rest of the flat suffered very minimal smoke damage.
It was clear that there was some form of link between these two murders, because the bodies were left in such a distinctive fashion and such a distinctive way that the same person had to be involved in both.
His first victim he killed, and then he set fire to her flat. And interestingly, he did exactly the same with his second victim. And what's also unusual about this case is that both victims lived within 100 yards or so of each other. So it was a very small killing zone. Most killers have quite a wide range of killing zone to start with. And as they get more and more confident, they get nearer to home. But he seems to have killed very close to home and close to both victims.
The proximity of the murders in both time and place was unheard of in a town such as Hastings. It generated an understandable sense of fear among the locals.
Oh, it was awful. I mean, everybody was shocked. When we heard about the first murder, it was just awful. And then to hear of another one a few days later, it was just, nobody could believe it. Things like that just didn't happen.
On the morning of our murder, I was listening to the radio, and it came over that there was a murder in these flats. And, you know, it really went through my mind, oh, my God, I hope Dawn's safe. Oh, well, I was horrified, absolutely horrified. She didn't deserve to have her life ended in that way, because she was too kind, she was too sweet. Everyone she met, she used to call sweetie. Everyone was sweetie to her. Hello, sweetie, that was her greeting, you know. So she didn't deserve to be murdered like that.
Barely a few days after Fisher had killed, indeed strangled and burnt, Beryl O'Connor, he was to attack again, but this time with a more obviously sexual motive. In a train from Hastings to Charing Cross in London, he traps a Czech student in the toilet. Now, this is a massive man, 18, 19 stone, a monstrous creature. What the poor girl must have suffered is unimaginable. What is absolutely clear, however, is that Fisher didn't kill her. Perhaps she put up too much of a fight. Perhaps he left the attack too late. Because what happened was her bloodied but still alive body was found by a train guard in the toilet.
Graham Fisher attacked the 19-year-old language student on the Hastings to Charing Cross main railway line. He attacked her very soon after it had left Hastings railway station, and disturbingly, probably when it was passing the back garden of Claire Letchford's lower basement flat, who he had murdered just a few days beforehand on the 19th of January 1998. He had said that he saw a very attractive young student sitting close by to him when he was on the train, and she moved to the toilet cubicle soon after it left the platform. He forced his way into the toilet cubicle and initiated what can only be described as a frighteningly violent, sexually driven attack on that young woman. He was so violent to her that she subsequently suffered a stroke and has suffered physically and mentally since that time. She was unconscious for many weeks, and he had stamped on her head, trying to crush it. She suffered a dislocated jaw as a result of that particular aspect of the attack. He sexually assaulted her, and she was not found in that toilet cubicle until the train was returning south, having been to Charing Cross, and she was found when the train arrived at Orpington, and the police and ambulance were called, and there was blood all around the toilet cubicle and it was thought at one stage that she was dead.
The two killings he actually carried out were both in flats. He then, later on, attacks a woman on a train, and it's clearly sexually motivated to do it. And it's quite interesting because it's a different type of crime. The first two, he's gone in, he's been in control. Now he's taking a lot more risks on a train where there more people could stop him. And also, he could be caught by being stuck on the train. But he's clearly not worried about that. He's seen an opportunity, pushing her into the toilet, trying to rape her. He's done that because he's seen the opportunity. So he's impulsive, and that makes him dangerous.
Within a few months of his attack, Fisher was to attack again. This time, he sexually assaults two Spanish students holding a knife to their throats. It was that attack in May that was finally to see Fisher incarcerated. But, and it is a significant but, he was never convicted of the murders that he had already committed in Hastings. That was to remain a mystery that was unsolved for several years.
Graham Fisher has been arrested for the sexual assault of two Spanish students in Eastbourne. He tells the investigators, chillingly, "She looked really scared, but this really turned me on." He is imprisoned for the attack. And after 3 years, is transferred from an ordinary prison to the secure hospital, Broadmoor. Because, and I quote, "He is regarded as immensely dangerous for him ever to be released." It takes him a further 7 years to confess to the crimes that he really should have been convicted of originally. The murder, cold-blooded, brutal killing of two vulnerable, lonely women, neighbours of his in Hastings. He also confesses to the attack on a Czech student on a train from Hastings to Charing Cross, and even worse perhaps, a further rape, this time in his native Bromley. There is something utterly chilling about the nature of that confession. I am absolutely certain in my own mind that he did it simply so that he could remain in Broadmoor in the cushier conditions. He knew perfectly well, when he was finally to stand trial for the murders, that the judge would take his confession into account. And he hoped, and I believe cynically, manipulatively decided, that that was his chance to stay in the comfortable conditions of Broadmoor rather than suffer the indignities and pressures of a more ordinary, straightforward prison.
In my opinion, it was a mixture of a number of things why Graham Fisher started to talk to us at that time. We do know that he was being considered for being put back into the prison population before a future release. So that was a factor that was weighing on his mind. He was certainly seen by himself and the staff as a very important character in the community at Broadmoor. He'd set himself up as such, and he'd got a lifestyle there where he was in a warm, comfortable place, four meals a day, and I think a small element of protection from the community, because there was a very faint trace in his interviews and confessions of regret, not very much, but enough for him to feel probably that if he went back outside into the community at large, he would commit further crimes and serious crimes. So I think there's probably a little bit of Graham Fisher that was saying, you know, don't go back outside. And one way of doing that was obviously talk to the police about the serious cases that he'd already been involved in.
When people like that are actually incarcerated and they then start making confessions about other murders, other attacks, other assaults, sometimes that can be seen as, again, this wanting to leave this long-lasting legacy, that it's a desire to be needed, to be wanted, to be viewed by the public as a monster. It's creating the full package, the full image. Normally, serial killers or murderers or sexual deviants or killers of any description, they don't normally come out and confess to their own crimes. I've interviewed an awful lot of killers, and they're very, very rare that they will come out. Number one, that they'll want to talk about their own crimes because they feel quite, not guilty, but they don't want to go there. They don't want to be judged on things of the past because 9 times out of 10 they've denied it. When you look at his profile, this man has all the makings of somebody who has done this before. And I think there'll be many more, if he's further investigated, many more victims can be linked to this individual.
Graham Fisher could fairly be described as a monster. He killed vulnerable, lonely women without any remorse, except finally to try and get himself a comfortable life in Broadmoor. I feel nothing but contempt for this 23-stone monster who presumably grown fat on the takeaway pizzas that are part of the regular diet for patients, or should I say prisoners, in Broadmoor. To add insult to injury, he then had a gastric band fitted at the price to the taxpayer of a mere £15,000. Fisher is a cynical, manipulative monster for whom no one should have the slightest sympathy.
Certainly everything that I know about Graham Fisher from when he was a young man until now is that he would continue to offend. He would be a very, very real and present danger to people. And he's one of those people that you come across in your investigative experience with the police from time to time that you really, really hope will never be released and that spending the rest of his time in confinement is not only best for him to stop him reoffending, but also best for the community at large.
Graham Fisher is without doubt the most dangerous man I have ever dealt with. He presents the most significant danger to women of any offender that I have dealt with. And I have experienced a number of murder inquiries and led a number of murder inquiries. And he is an extremely dangerous individual who presents an existing and ongoing threat to women. And that's why I believe that the words of Justice Keith, the trial judge, when he said that you can expect to spend many decades in prison, is absolutely correct. I'm sure he will.
When Fisher finally confesses in a cynical attempt to make sure he goes back to Broadmoor, he says, "Oh, it was because it's so hard to live with it in my head." What complete claptrap. He makes himself feel like a victim. But what about the dreadful killings of those two innocent, vulnerable, lonely women? Fisher is no kind of victim. Fisher is a monster and should be dismissed exactly as such.
Thank you.
Join me, Geoffrey Wonsall, next time for more Murders by the Sea.